Hello, and welcome back to the studio. I have Sister Denise here with me, who has just addressed us on the subject of the despondency of Arjuna, what his pain is, what it means. And now we move on to chapter 2, which is the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of knowledge. And so we have last seen Arjuna drop his bow and arrow and stand in front of Krishna in utmost sorrow at the idea of killing family members. So, Sister Denise, a very warm welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
In this chapter, God answers Arjuna for the first time. Now, the question that I have is, before we get to what his answers contain, we know that Arjuna and Krishna are together from the beginning of chapter 1, but we have to wait until the second chapter in order to hear God's voice, as it were, to hear God's words. So God communicates using the medium of words to Arjuna only in chapter 2. My question is more subtle. Does God communicate with Arjuna in any other way except words?
The main thing is words, but the words have so much import, and the link between Krishna and Arjuna, between God and Arjuna, is such that it covers so much depth of relationship. So there's much that is sort of understood, but what we have on the piece of paper is the words. And it's interesting that in the text of the Gita, the second chapter starts with Shri Bhagwan Uvach. And that is a very important statement. And so Shri means the purest of the pure, the most elevated one. Bhagwan is a very commonly used word for God, and Bhagwan also means the fortune maker. So again, the one who creates your fortune is the one who teaches you the knowledge of karma, because you can only have good fortune if you perform pure action. That's also a precursor to what we will find out later as Krishna explains to Arjuna the depth of the philosophy of karma. But here, he's really, you know, addressing the situation. But this first expression, Shri Bhagwan Uvach, it's like, okay, the teacher is about to speak, and this is the teacher. And then he launches into his statements.
I hear the drum roll. At the end of chapter 1, we see that Arjuna has fallen. And I know you covered this a bit at the end of chapter 1, but I'd like you to repeat it for those souls who may be joining us for the first time. How has Arjuna fallen, and what is the extent of his fall?
Essentially, Arjuna has refused to fight, and he's avoiding the whole question of dealing with the tremendous ethical dilemma that he's in, and he has preferred to make himself look ignominious than to perform an aggressive act which is against his principles. So he's fallen quite far down in the eyes of Krishna, or the eyes of God.
I asked you this question before, but for the purpose of souls who've just joined us, once again, could you tell us briefly what this war is about?
Well, the war is the inner war, the outer war, the whole question of family feuds, which is a big subject in the world today. It also covers the question of civil war, which is a very terrible type of war, because you're fighting those who normally you should be loyal to. And so the correct way of doing things is absolutely turned upside down when you have a civil war, because normally war is with some outside people, someone who's not you. But here it's all turned within, and that makes it very difficult to manage. And this is really Arjuna's dilemma too, that he just does not want to deal with it.
The first thing that God gives to Arjuna is courage. And the English translation is, do not be timid, stand up and fight. Why is it necessary for Arjuna to receive this courage at the onset under the chapter Yoga of Knowledge?
Well, the master, huh, the martial arts master, is always going to put the student in a situation where they are very intimidated. And at the same time, Krishna is not being an aggressive. You know, normally in military training, they're really awful to the trainees, really awful, in order to make a person aggressive out of fear. But here, it's not like that. He's giving him courage. He's saying, no, you can do it. It is encouragement rather than force, you know? So you see the character of God being very different from the character of those who choose to exemplify authority through aggression. So there's a very interesting counterpoint. And he has to have courage because it's a very, very difficult thing that he has to do, because he has to face everything that he considers right and re-look at that, so that he is then able to take on the angle on right and wrong which God gives, which is actually quite different from the angle on right and wrong that he's received through tradition, through his culture, through the wisdom that is transferred from generation to generation. Because you see, what God is going to do is challenge that received wisdom and say that it is no longer relevant. It doesn't work anymore. And so the usefulness of God is to come and give something which does work and which is very different from this age-old received wisdom, which in a way we have to admit comes from human beings. So when we're looking at the two strands, you have, you know, conventional moral ideas about what's right and wrong, and then you have the angle of God, which comes from which is the name of the chapter, Yoga of Knowledge. So God is also called the knowledgeful one. And then human beings are looking for knowledge. A human being knows something by observation, whereas God knows something by just knowing. So it's very different. And as I mentioned in another episode, God is not a human. And people try to, if they want to personalize God, they'll bring him down to the human level. Then there's others who refuse to do that, and they make God completely inaccessible and incomprehensible. So either way, you remain far from God. So then it's only God who can say, look, you know, this is me, here I am, okay, I'm in my beautiful form, so that you're not too scared. Because normally a person's sense of God is such that they'd be way too scared to sit in the same chariot.
Okay, Sister Denise, God has spoken to Arjuna, encouraged him. And Arjuna's response is, I shall not fight. Okay, so Arjuna is in the presence of somebody whom he recognizes as God. God has spoken to him, and his pain and fear and trauma is greater than his respect and affection for God.
Well, absolutely. And I would say that when he's doing that, he's not recognizing God as God. He's talking to Krishna as his friend, and he's forgotten who he's talking to, and therefore he argues and becomes petulant and just refuses. He's still on his position he's attached to that position of morality. And because of that, he's dealing with Krishna as if he's just another human being. You know, a great teacher, no doubt, but not supreme God, you see.
Mm. On page 4, Arjuna makes reference to Bhishma and Drona, and he defines them, and well, it's the translation that I have, as two venerable men. Okay? Mm-hmm. Who do these two people represent, Bhishma and Drona?
Well, Bhishma and Drona are the righteous warriors in the generation ahead of Arjuna, because they are the teachers. They are the teachers of military strategy and weapons management, weapons technology. And they represent the traditions, you see, that Arjuna is connected with, that he's attached to. But the problem is that they are paid by the enemy. And so, again, you've got another layer of paradox. In the description that runs up to the war, Drona and Bhishma are the teachers of the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who together, as cousins growing up, learned the arts of war. So their loyalty has to stay with the Kauravas. They have to stay on that side, you see. And in all of the drama leading up to their exile and the gambling and the loss and everything, they, according to circumstances, had their hands tied. They were unable to speak. They were unable to say anything because of the laws of diplomacy.
Sister Denise, on page 7 of my translation, Arjuna uses the words, "Tell me your pupil." So the reader is introduced to God as a teacher. God is a teacher to humanity?
God is the supreme father, mother, teacher, guru, guide, you know. And there is this word acharya, the teacher, religious teacher. God is known as the one who knows, you know. He is the one who conveys truth. So that means he has to be the teacher, you know, because the concepts that are contained in the intellect of God are required in human beings in order for there to be transformation of the human psyche, which is what God does. God transforms ordinary mortals into immortals, deities, virtuous beings who are no longer limited by what we call the human condition. And so he has to come as a teacher.
Once we find that Arjuna still refuses to fight, despite God saying to him, you know, do not be coward, do not be timid, stand up. God expands on his answer to Arjuna and says the following: "Truly there was never a time when I was not, nor you, nor these lords of men, and neither will there be a time when we shall cease to be from this time onward. Just as in the body, childhood, adulthood, and old age happen to an embodied being, so also the embodied being acquires another body, and the wise one is not deluded about this." This is the first real message from God to his friend. Tell us about that. What is the significance of this under the chapter Yoga of Knowledge being delivered first?
Basically, it's talking about what a human soul is. And so the first thing that he's saying about the human spirit is that it is eternal, it is immortal. God is eternal and immortal. You and I and all other human beings are eternal and immortal. And I think we have a very interesting matter of distinction. In the teachings of Raj Yoga that we learn in Brahma Kumaris, a human soul always is a human soul. So we're talking about reincarnation here, but the soul will always reincarnate as a human being. Could be in the form of a male, could be in the form of a female, but the soul cannot transmigrate species. And also...
Okay, hold on. Repeat that, please. That's quite a bomb that you've dropped. A soul cannot...
transmigrate to another species.
So meaning a human soul will not find itself in the body of a dog or a cat.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And also, the god soul can never become a human soul, and the human soul can never become a god soul. You know, there's the expression that you hear sometimes, God is one. And people don't really know exactly what that means, God is one, or there's only one God. But basically, the way we look at it is the Supreme Soul, the father, mother, teacher of all souls, is there's only one like that and is not a human soul and is on a different level altogether. But the difference is human souls, there are many, 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 many. Animal souls, there are many. Insect souls, there are many. There's many, many of all these things, but there's only one of this particular type of soul, which is God. So absolutely unique and cannot be accessed by a human being through their own capacity for perception. So what happens is people believe in God or they don't believe in God. But they cannot know God unless God reveals himself or herself to them. So this is the beginning of that whole concept. And also very important for a human being to begin to consider the self, that there has never ever been a time when I personally didn't exist as myself. So when you reincarnate, you don't become somebody else. You're the same person. And you get a different body, different parents, different brothers and sisters. You may be born into a different race, but you'll still be a human being. You may be born into a different religion, but you'll still be a human being. You may be born into not a very good condition. That will be because of your karma. You may be born in a very good condition, and that will be because of your positive karma. So the question of karma comes into it. But the first thing that God is saying is, you are an eternal, immortal being, and your identity doesn't change. You get different bodies, but your actual self is always. That's a big
identity.
Thing.
I like that. Your identity does not change. So, Denise, we go on to the next aspect that was of interest to me, where the next piece of advice Arjuna receives from God is physical sensations truly, Arjuna, causing cold, heat, pleasure or pain, come and go and are impermanent, so manage to endure them, Arjuna. Okay, so this is a interesting way of being, because most of us like the pleasure and run away from the pain. You like cold or heat, but he's talking about managing polarities, okay? And I think my understanding of it is telling Arjuna, manage your feelings.
Yes.
Okay? Why is this so important? And more specifically, why do so few of us succeed in this department?
The thing is this, there are some spiritual laws that apply here. You mentioned that we like the pleasure, we don't like the pain. Mm. We like comfort, we don't like discomfort. What happens among the laws of spirituality is that if you accept something that's positive, you take that into yourself, you receive that positive, beneficial, pleasant experience, you are obligated and you cannot avoid receiving its opposite. So if you want the pleasure, you will have to take the pain. Now when Krishna says you've got to endure these polarities. That's a very interesting teaching, you see, because a yogi, a person who's a serious spiritual warrior, has to become independent of these sense pleasures and sense displeasures, you see, because it's only by moving away from these polarities that you can actually shift from the dimension of sense perception, which is a materialistic dimension, onto the dimension of being just pure consciousness, you see. And that's what we want to go to.
Sister Denise, page 15 gets more fascinating. The wise one to whom happiness and unhappiness are the same is ready for immortality. I have yet to meet such a person who is this neutral. I've met people who strive to be. The aim of most people, of what they strive for, their quest, as you put it in an earlier episode, is I want to be happy. Not I want to not be affected by happiness and unhappiness. And for many, the question is, if I'm not happy, what is the point of being alive? How do you interpret our ambitions as human beings and our need to be happy and our the goal of one's life and what certain psychologists will call self-actualization? How do you interpret all of that in the light of this advice? This is hard.
Well, Raj Yoga is supposed to be the most difficult thing there is.
Right. That explains why you're doing it.
Well, if it's going to be that easy, why would you bother?
Okay, we'll leave that for a different conversation, shall we?
No, but the thing is this. Okay, what does a person strive for? There are different people striving for different things. So one thing that many monastic people will strive for, who make spirituality the total focus of their lives, they will strive for something called mukti. Mukti means that you leave the body and you don't come back. You want to go into the light, known as Brahman or Paramdham or Paralok. There's many different words. Nirvana is probably the most well known. You want to go to Nirvana and not come back. Because what people don't like is what they see as the bondage to matter and Maya. So Maya being generally considered to mean illusion or delusion. And here we're beginning to get into that whole question with the sense perceptions do delude the soul. Because when you see something beautiful, you say, this is beautiful. And it's beautiful because you perceive it to be beautiful. Is it really beautiful? Well, there are different criteria. So the criteria for a beautiful woman is at a particular point in time, her body is so perfect that, okay, we call that absolutely beautiful, but then she will age, and then that beauty is then transient, you see. So then we'll say, well, it's a delusion because you can't hold on to something that only lasts for a moment or so. So it's really the question of anything material that is really attractive only endures for a little time. And then the criteria for something being real in certain philosophical traditions is that it has to remain stably in that state. And so if you say, okay, the description of God is certain things, certain qualities which do not change. So for example, in the biblical tradition, you will hear of God being described as immutable, immortal, eternal, immutable, absolutely doesn't change. Whereas a person who is caught up in sense perception is dealing only with change. because things come, they stay for a little bit, they go, something else comes, stays for a little bit and goes. So the person who's called wise is the one who's understood that, and that you will never say that something is a certain thing. You will just see that it is like that for a little while. But because you know it's transient, you won't try and hold on to it, because it doesn't make any sense to hold on to something that doesn't have durability.
It doesn't make sense to hold on to something that does not have durability.
Right.
Okay. Sister Denise, people feel alive when they experience. If you are neutral all the time, isn't it like a walking corpse? Well, no, I'm speaking on behalf of the millions watching you right now who think this is such a beautiful idea. I wish all the best for the person who's brave enough to try to be this. We're not disputing the veracity of these words. Mm. However, the reason happiness exists as an emotion is so that we can actually feel it. And what makes us happy is the people that we love, the things that we do, the vacations that we aspire to, our dreams and ambitions give us happiness. Now, this says what? And another part of this question is that there's a direct link between emotional neutrality and immortality.
Yes.
And that's like, I'm sorry, what?
That's the thing. Your description of happiness is one interpretation of happiness, but there's other interpretations of happiness.
Tell me.
Because happiness means fortune.
Oh. Okay.
So fortune means that you have figured out or you've understood how to do absolutely perfect karma, which results in permanent or almost permanent wealth, health, good relationships, beauty, etc., etc., very, very long term. So there's a difference that's given between short term and long term. So very, very long-term happiness is a product of expertly performed karma over a long period of time, which is what God the teacher teaches, as compared with the hedonist who says, I'm going to satisfy this craving of my sense perception, whether it's for food or for sex or for whatever people crave for, which gives you, you know, as they say, for food, a second on the lips and a lifetime on the hips.
I'm familiar with that concept myself.
No, but do you see what I'm saying? Mm. It's so short-lived. And people classify that as happiness, and they don't distinguish between this very ephemeral happiness of the hedonist as compared with the long-term happiness of the disciplined one who realizes that happiness is not an emotion.
What is it?
It's a state of being where you are in life and you are free. So the word for that is jivan mukti. So you have mukti, which means you leave and you go to nirvana and don't come back, which of course you have to come back because you can't just disappear. You're eternal, you're immortal. So you have the ephemeral happiness, you have the avoidance of all that, and then you have long-term happiness, which is you are liberated and you are in the body, you are in life. But your body doesn't give you a problem, your relations don't give you a problem, you have absolutely everything you have to have over a long, long period of many, many births. Traditionally, it is said that 21 births of happiness. Mm. So that's not an emotion, that's a state, karmic consequences.
Okay, we have to stop there, tragically. luckily, we're going to see Sister Denise again for the next episode, which I believe will be episode 5. As you can see, chapter 2 is the beginning of the conversation between the soul and the supreme soul, between Arjuna and Krishna as it's depicted in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's such a rich chapter that I do not wish to hurry through it. And as you see, the answer that Sister Denise is delivering is quite loaded. And every answer that Sister Denise gives, I need to ask another question. So we're going to go through it slowly so that you at home can understand the depth and the wisdom that this magnificent scripture that emerges from ancient India has to offer you. So thank you for joining us today, and we hope to see you soon for episode 5. Thank you and goodbye.